Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at Community Progressive Radio or CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Today we have a wonderful, wonderful show for you. As always, we have the magnificent author, cartoonist, I should say revolutionary author and cartoonist, Ted Rall. Ted has a quite extensive biography, and he has a wonderful background. And you can see his background at my website, CindySheehanSoapbox.com. I'm going to post his biography there. My blog, I'm very pleased to announce that my blog has many new writers. I've opened it up to some authors who have touched me and motivated me and inspired me, and I hope they inspire you too. I'm hoping that Cindy Sheehan Soapbox will be an interactive place for radical thought, revolutionary thought, true left-wing thought. So we're very excited about expanding the blog and expanding the radio show and expanding the website. And we thank you for your support, and we thank you for listening to the show and reading our post at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. So without further ado, I'm going to bring on Ted Rall.
Ted Rall, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thanks for having me, Cindy. It's awesome to be here with you.
Well, it's great to talk to you again and to have you on the show. Thank you so much. We're going to mostly talk about your book. Your new book is called The Book of Obama, How We Got from Hope and Change to the Age of Revolt. And people can order that, I think, from your website at tedrall.com, right? TedRALL.com.
That's right. They can get it from me directly, or you can get it from any bookstore.
And we will give you an opportunity to say your website again or any other relevant information at the end of the interview. But first we're going to talk about Barack Obama. It's called The Book of Obama. And one of the questions that I think you attempt to answer in the book is, how did a charismatic young president elected in an atmosphere of optimism and expectation lead the United States to the brink of revolution?
Yeah, that's what I attempt to answer in the book. I came to the conclusion pretty early on that Obama was a lot like Mikhail Gorbachev, the last leader of the Soviet Union. You know, Gorbachev was the nicest, most progressive, most charming, most intelligent leader that the Soviet Union ever had, certainly, since Lenin. And yet, just when they're getting a good leader, the Russian people turned against the system and got rid of it. Not through
a
revolution, more through collapse.
Yeah.
A lot of people think it's ironic, but I don't think it's ironic. I think what happened was that once they had a leader who wasn't a complete asshole, they were able to see that that the system was really what was keeping them down. And I think it's sort of the same thing here. I mean, here, you know, the big defense of Obama nowadays for re-election is that he's ineffectual. I mean, it's pretty funny when you think about it.
Yeah.
That's what his defenders say, right? Like, he can't do anything because of the mean Republicans in Congress. Which, the problem with that talking point, by the way, is that it asks you to forget 2009, when he came in and he had control of both houses of Congress by an overwhelming majority. He had a veto, he had a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. He had, he had incredible political capital, very high approval ratings. Even people who had voted for McCain came over to support Obama after he was became president. The media loved him. And, of course, we were all scared because the economy was tanking, losing 600,000 jobs a month. So people were really, they really were pretty much would have gone along with anything he wanted to do. So, like, for instance, this past week, he did sort of the Dream Act light thing. But he could have passed the real Dream Act back in 2009. Or, people this year are saying, oh, well, we should vote for him because if we don't, women lose the right to choose because the Supreme Court could move even further to the right. But in 2009, he could have actually proposed a federal law legalizing abortion. People forget that. You know, that's really the solution. And he might have gotten it through, or he should have at least tried. So the thing is that, we don't know really what's in Barack Obama's heart. We don't know whether he would have done more, if he could have done more, and I don't really care. I mean, what matters is the results. That's psychology. That's of interest to historians, what he wanted to do. But what's of interest to me as a citizen who cares about all of us is to say, well, look, let's look at the policies. Let's see what he tried to do. I mean, there's no evidence that he was ever really a liberal, or much less a progressive, much less a radical. I wish he were, but he just isn't. I think that what happened is, first in 2009 with the Tea Party on the right, the original Tea Party, the pre-co-opted Tea Party, mm-hmm. then Occupy Wall Street on the left, we saw people start to turn away from the two-party trap and look outside to street politics to understand that people have a lot of power if they organize and they talk to each other. And they start to realize that politics is not something that happens just every 2 to 4 years on election day. Politics is something that happens every day while you're listening to your podcast, while you're talking to your friends, your neighbors, when you're at work or not at work, an employment office, anywhere you are. Those conversations, those are real politics. And that what's going on C-SPAN and CNN is just a charade. It's just a carnival. It's of no more meaning to your life than, you know, who wins the baseball game. So people are starting to. It's an interesting thing. Under George W. Bush, it was entirely possible to think that if we got a president who, for instance, could speak English, who was not a complete buffoon and manic and weird and warmongering idiot, which he was and is, that we'd do better. Well, we now have a president. I guess he's still a warmonger, but he's not, he's certainly not an idiot, and he's certainly able to use the English language. So, here we are, right? Still out of work, still at war, still sinking ourselves down the hole of militarism for no good reason, except for the naked avarice of a few. So people are starting to see that voting or not voting, voting Democratic or voting Republican, or for that matter, voting Green, it doesn't really have much effect, and that people need to look somewhere else for change.
Well, you actually say that. You said that we weren't lied to, we lied to ourselves. And we lied to ourselves about Obama and the two-party system, and we voted when we ought to have revolted. And I assume, you're talking about 2008, where a lot of people lied to themselves about Obama and the two-party system. Some of us didn't. But what should we have done? Revolted is kind of a broad, it could mean a lot of things. What do you think in 2012, for example, we have another election coming up, where you see people who did start to become disillusioned with Obama and the system? Even some Occupy activists are saying, well, we have to vote for Obama because if we don't vote for Obama, we might get Romney. What's a better alternative to voting in 2012?
Well, the real alternative is to voting. It's not necessarily not voting. The alternative is just to not spend much time or psychic energy thinking about voting. Vote or don't vote for Obama, it doesn't matter. Send them $100 if you want, if you've got it. But a lot like, in the environmental movement, they talk about lifestyle activism. Lifestyle activism is you drive a Prius and you recycle and you have solar energy panels, so you think you're saving the planet. Well, you're not saving the planet. The planet's still going to heat up. The species are still going to die. Industrial capitalism is the problem. And I drive a hybrid and I recycle and I would like solar panels if I could afford them. I mean, it's just being pulled up. It's lifestyle environmentalism. Well, lifestyle, in a way, I call this lifestyle politics. Going to vote, working for Move On, that's lifestyle politics. In a sense, even like what I do, drawing political cartoons or writing, you know, it's not real activism. It makes people aware, but it's not real action. It's not going to change anything. It's just, it might lead other people to change things at some point, but it's not going to change anything. And so, you know, it's really going, so I'm, you know, you're right. You know, revolt is a very vague term, and I have in mind the overthrow of government, which is something that I called for much more explicitly in my last book, The Anti-American Manifesto.
Right.
I feel that we're at that state where we're headed toward collapse, and every day that these guys are still in power, they're raping the planet, they're murdering people and animals and plants, and they're not going to stop unless they're forced to be stopped. But I left the term vague because I think too many Americans really want a leader to step forward and tell them what to do. And that's exactly what we don't need. What we really need is real democracy, where we all get together as equals and sit and work this out the hard way, and argue about it, and fight about it, and insult each other, and laugh, and dance, and scream, and everything, and just have it out. And as a nation, we have to, we have to roll up our sleeves and reinvent this thing. And that's why I say revolt. Well, that means different things to different people. I mean, I know what it means to me, I can't do it by myself. So it really has to be like Occupy. You know, they always have to reach consensus. We need a consensus on this. We don't need 320 million people to agree, because there's never been a revolution led by 100% of the people. But mm-hmm. you do need some sort of consensus that most people are willing to go along with, like, so that the people who are not willing to be involved in the national conversation are at least tacitly willing to give their consent to be governed by whatever comes next. You need at least that number. Well, who knows what that is, but, God knows we're nowhere near that now. We don't have anything. There's no left at all in this country. There's no left.
Exactly. What do you talk about that for a minute, your idea of there not being a left in the country?
Well, I mean, so, for instance, we have progressives, obviously, and we have liberals, but we don't have a left. A left is an organized force, usually a party, but it doesn't have to be, that wants to replace the entire social, political, and economic system with something brand new from the ground up. So they're revolutionaries. They're people who, they don't want to amend the Constitution or write a new one or elect better members of Congress. They want to burn down Congress. They want to rip up the Constitution. They want to start from scratch, see what we need to do. They don't care if there's 50 states or 2 states or no states. Everything's up in the air. There's nothing like that in this country. In other countries, in this country, there used to be, until the early 70s, there were groups like that that imagined a completely different world and tried to fight towards it. But there's nothing like that here. And what's even more frightening is that there are no intellectuals who are even able to paint a picture of what something different would look like. I mean, even people on the quote-unquote left, like, say, Noam Chomsky, he doesn't want to put the president on trial and jail Congress and jail the CEOs. And, he wants radical change. Radical change, yes, but total change, I don't think so. So, fundamentally, that's the problem, is that there's no, and I think, people who are, like, listening to this, maybe liberals or progressives, might say, well, we don't need those people. But they're wrong, because even if you're a progressive or a socialist or a liberal, you do need people on the far left to be able to sort of provide that benchmark measurement, first of all, to say what the extreme version of your own ideology would look like, and also you need them to sort of counterweight the extreme right, which is there, always pushing the needle all the way to the right. I mean, if Barack Obama in 1960 would have been considered to the right of Richard Nixon. I mean, Richard Nixon never thought, it was okay to assassinate American citizens. This is a right-wing president, but the needle's been pushed so far to the right, we can't see that. And that's why you need a hard left, a real left, in order to define that. Even if you don't personally, I do consider myself there. But there are, you know, but for people who are comfortable with it, you know, you need us. You really do.
Well, I'm on the same, I'm down there with you on the far left spectrum, but that was my next question was going to be, I think the terms have been all distorted because, of course, you know, people like Hillary Clinton are defined as being on the left, and Barack Obama is called a socialist, and so the terms are so distorted that there's, you know, it doesn't really, they don't make any sense anymore.
No, they really don't. I mean, you know, I was thinking about Barry Goldwater. You know, in 1964, he lost to LBJ because he was considered a wild, crazy-eyed warmonger who was going to blow up the world with nukes.
Mm-hmm.
Today, if he was, he would be far to the left of the Democratic Party. He could not get into the Democratic primaries because he would be too far to the left. I mean, he was a guy who was in favor of gay marriage years ago. You know, I mean, this is he was definitely a constitutional theorist. He didn't believe that, for instance, the president had the right to declare war, which is, of course, true in our Constitution. The president doesn't have the right to commit troops to battle. And, you know, I mean, imagine what a better country we would live in if you know, the people actually had to vote directly, which is how it really should be, as to whether or not we commit troops. I don't care if we send 10 trainers somewhere. We should all be involved in that decision. And it's a, you know, I mean, it's life and death. You know, but now we've got drones all over the place. And, you know, I mean, the needle's just moved so far to the right that it's incomprehensible. I mean, you keep asking yourself, I'm sure you do, I do, like, you know, when's it going to stop? I mean, what's it going to take to make people so angry that they just don't, they refuse to take it anymore?
Well, the question that you attempt to answer in your book is that, it's been, the United States has been led to the brink of a revolution. You know, I think that's just what you said. What's it going to take? What's it going to take to push us over the brink and into whatever kind of revolution that we need to have?
Yeah, well, I mean, nobody can predict that. I mean, you know, like Robert Kennedy famously said that those who, you know, that revolution seems impossible until it, and you know, it seems impossible until it happens, and after it happens, it seems retroactively inevitable. He said it better than I do,
okay.
But he said everything better. But the thing is that I think that's right. I think you know, I mean, it's going to be impossible for it to ever happen. And then when it does happen, it'll seem like the most obvious thing in the world. It'll, you know, think about something like, say, the housing bubble that people like Paul Krugman were talking about in the, you know, mid 2000s. Oh, that's going to blow up, you know, the economy is going to come crashing down, these prices are ridiculous, but nobody believed in, and the banks kept issuing loans. And then, of course, after the crash, it's, you know, of course, then conventional wisdom switches, and, you know, the Thomas Friedmans of the world, who never saw it coming and claimed it never could happen, turn around and say, well, of course, we always knew this was going to happen. So that's, you know, that's how it is. So, it's, I mean, you know, who knows what will set it off. It's usually, I mean, if history serves, you know, we certainly have most of the requirements that we need for revolution. We have very high unemployment, very high disparity of wealth. We have one of the key ingredients that people don't talk about is the failure of young people, young educated elites who normally would be able to find good jobs after college, mm-hmm. are finding themselves unable to advance into the system. That's something that happened to be right before the French Revolution, where the sons of the bourgeoisie were suddenly unable to find work. Same thing right before the Russian Revolution, right before the British Revolution under Cromwell. So that's a big, like, you know, a lot of theorists point to that, and they say, yeah, you know, that's a big indicator. But, you know, that said, I mean, it's entirely theoretically possible that the system could reform itself enough to stave off revolution, as FDR did in the 30s. But I just don't think so. I don't believe so, because I think you can sort of see the fact that there's been no stimulus to help people, only banks, is a pretty good indication. You know, unemployment, welfare, social programs, those are all like revolution be gone. Those are like ways for the elites to keep us, you know, happy watching TV and not and playing video games and not overthrowing them. But the fact that they can't get that stuff going indicates to me that they can't even save themselves, and that's why I think it's not even reformable. I mean, it was always an immoral system, but I think it's broken. Immoral, it was always immoral, but now it's broken too. By its own standards, it just can't go on.
Well, what about, like you said, the children of the elite, the bourgeois, they can't get jobs. What about the children of the working class? I think that here in the United States, we have a situation where they're working to put themselves through school. They're taking on these terrible loans. They can't find jobs, and they still have to pay the loans back. I think that is what led, I think, to a lot of the young people that go to the Occupy movement. But I think it's like a time bomb.
Oh, well, I agree. I mean, and look, the working class, if you're a Marxist, and I'm mostly a Marxist, the working class leads the revolution. You can't have one without one. But, you know, but when I was referring to the bourgeoisie, that's kind of like the spark that sets it, because, you know, to be cynical about it, working class poor people are used to being working class poor. They're being ground up, and even when good quote unquote times are good, they're always suffering, right? So the difference here is that they get sympathy and assistance and the initial spark from those other young people who make things happen. But there's no doubt. I mean, the reservoir of rage is huge. I mean, if you calculated unemployment the same way we did in the 30s, we're at 23 to 24% unemployment, the same as the height of the Great Depression in 1934. So it's, you know, I mean, the only difference is we don't have bread lines, because ironically, there's not enough social services to provide bread. So people are sleeping under bridges and invisible, or they're tripling up at their, you know, relative's house. But it doesn't mean the anger is not there. They just right now, you know, why riot? There's, you can't riot by yourself. You need an outlet, and you need other people to join you. So that's why it's not happening. But it's only a matter of time.
So I also see that, you know, we're seeing, I think, people, you know, we're seeing the collapse, I think, of the myth of the American dream. You know, the only reason that, for example, my daughter got $50,000 in loans to get her master's degree is because, you know, she believed that when she finished school, she was going to be able to get a job in her field, but now she's a bartender. And, you know, the only reason my son went into the military is to get his college education and, you know, to have the government pay for his college education, and he's dead. So, you know, I think we're seeing, and what's frightening people is the collapse of the myth of the American dream.
Well, yeah, in a sense, it's kind of like the American dream is a Ponzi scheme, right? Like what you described.
Right.
You know, your children, you know, they, one investing his life and the other one mortgaging her future, for this sort of this idea that there will be a payoff if you just keep doing this. Well, it works as long as it keeps working, and then when it doesn't work, it really doesn't work. And this is kind of goes back to what I was saying about the system being unreformable. If the system were smart, I mean, if the elites were smart, what they would do is they'd say, okay, well, we recognize that in this particular case, at this particular time, you know, we overextended, and obviously we don't have as many jobs as we would like to offer as people need, so we're just going to forgive student loans, an example.
Mm-hmm.
They could do that. I mean, they have the money. It's not like it would change anything. It would actually probably really improve the economy.
Right.
You know, because a lot
sure.
of people buy houses. Right.
My daughter didn't have $500 she had to pay back to the government. That would be $500 that would be going into the local economy.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Either it would go into a bank as savings that could be invested, or it could be spent on consumer goods. So the thing is that, yeah, I mean, obviously that money is, but like Marx predicted that there would be, in the final crisis of capitalism, you would see a it's sort of the split in the ruling classes between the liberal ruling elites and the conservative elites tips to the balance of the conservative elites. And you're seeing that now with you know, the austerity people have won the argument, and against people, the people who are pro-stimulus, people like Ben Bernanke and Warren Buffett, they're not, you know, those people aren't winning the argument anymore like FDR did. FDR barely won it. You know, he was called a traitor to his class. And so that's why I think that, you know, if these people were smart, they would realize they're sitting, like you said, they're sitting on a time bomb of tens of millions of seriously pissed off and righteously pissed off people. I mean, this is it's going to change. I mean, this cannot go on. It's not feasible.
I think this will be the last question. I read a column you wrote about unemployment recently called Recovery, What Recovery? And also there's been, I also recently read, you know, hundreds of thousands of jobs outsourced from the United States. And then today there's a post in the Atlantic business blog about, it's called The Filthy Stinking Rich Are Creating Their Own Economy. And they used to be filthy stinking rich because they've exploited our labor and our resources and, you know, our natural resources. So how's that going to affect you know, this revolution that we wish would come?
Well, I mean, that's a huge question. I mean, you know, the thing is that the wealthy have managed to insulate themselves, you know, both in their gated communities and with behind security walls, and they live in different places than we do. So, you know, they have this illusion that they're impervious, and that due to the internationalization of things, they think that. You know, I think they really feel like if there were trouble in the United States, they could maybe go to France, and if there were trouble in France, maybe they could go to Italy or whatever. But I think that I remember back in 1990, I attended a forum about globalization at Berkeley, and I was just, you know, really depressed at the time because I thought, you know, the capitalism, it has won. There's no way to beat these people. They can build a plant in, you know, if they want to build a plant in India, they can move, you know, all the jobs there. Where wages are low and there's no unions, and there's no way we can fight them because labor isn't mobile, right? You can't go to, say, Qatar, which at the time had the highest average salary in the world. You can't go work in the UAE. You know, you're not allowed. So I thought these guys have got it game. And but I'm wrong. I mean, as we've seen with Occupy and the internet and technology and globalization, every new development cuts both ways. Everything that they use to oppress us can be used to rebel against them. And that's always the way it's been. You know, it's kind of like they can use drones to kill us, but we can build drones too. And there's going to be a thing in the sense that when the revolution, you know, the old communist dream of a global, simultaneous global revolution is now, you know, something that is imaginable. It never really was before. It was, the world was so not interconnected enough for that. But now it is. So I don't think these people are going to be able to get away with it. You know, when the crunch comes, maybe an entire third of the world will revolt all at the same time. I mean, look at what's going on in Europe. Imagine if like a two-thirds of the Eurozone revolted at the same time, the global implications that would have. It's easy to see big changes happening. So, I mean, I'm optimistic and at the same time. But, you know, I am sure that the changes are going to come, and when they come, they're going to be big.
Well, Ted, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. And can you just remind my listeners where they can, look at your political and social cartoons and get information about your book and your articles and things like that?
Sure. Thanks, Cindy, again, for having me on. The website is RALL.com, and you can buy my books there. And the book, the latest book, is called The Book of Obama, How We Went from Hope and Change to the Age of Revolt.
Ted Rall, again, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thank you, Cindy.
And good luck with everything.
Thanks, you too.
That's our show for today. I hope you enjoyed it. And I also hope you go to Ted Rall's website and check out his political cartoons and his articles. And as always, I'd like to thank Don DeBar and Community Progressive Radio, my producer Mikey, you for listening and supporting the show at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. And I'd like to thank Ted Rall for being on the show today. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.